Okay, I think we're about to get started as people are joining, and I'm sure we'll have some more attendees come in the next couple of minutes. But happy Friday and welcome to another installment of our Shields Health System Pharmacy Exchange, where we're continuing to focus on COVID-19. For those of you who haven't joined us in the past, this is intended to be a very quick and casual review of both facts and experiences for you to apply to your health system-owned specialty practice. The webinar is being recorded, and the recording and the slides will be available shortly, probably early next week. Additionally, we have a number of tools available regarding some of the topics that we talk about, and we also send out a weekly policy briefing, so please reach out if you're interested in receiving either of those things or you'd like to learn more. So today you're going to hear from my team, the Health System Strategy team here at Shields. I'm Erin Hendrick, and I'm joined by Chris Pacillo and Stephen Davis. We're extremely lucky to have Gary Kerr join us today. As the CPO for Bay State Health, he has led the COVID action plan for his department, and he's gonna share what he has done and observed in leading these efforts at Bay State. But I'm gonna kick it off with some basic facts to set the stage on the COVID journey. And I apologize because it's actually rather bleak where we're starting today. So as of this morning, there are nearly 1.5 million confirmed cases of COVID-19 in the United States. This is up 25,000 from yesterday. And deaths are nearing 100,000, which are up from about 1,300 from yesterday. So as many of you know, these numbers have been slightly variable based on how different states are reporting. So they do bump around a lot, but they do continue to go up. As we look to the country, 37 of our states have eased at least one social distancing rule. 29 still have their stay-at-home orders intact as originally put forth, but these have been implemented or eased or lifted in about 16 of the states. A quarantine for travelers remains in place for 20 states, and in 14 states, the original non-essential business closures remain intact. So then as we look into healthcare, early prescription refill rules were enacted in 18 states with no action in 33 states. And you'll see some of that when we go into the data that we've seen in terms of health system specialty pharmacy. The payment of premiums for health insurance has been extended in 11 states for any reason, and in 5 states for COVID-related reasons only. And then 12 states have opened up their marketplace for special enrollment to purchase health insurance. As of March 15th, approximately 39 million people have filed for unemployment, many of those in low income brackets. And so as we're nearing, 10 weeks or so into the crisis, those employees who are eligible for COBRA will be likely falling off of that this summer. And it's anticipated that we're gonna see some large surges in Medicaid and self-pay patient populations. Hospital margins have hit an all-time low. Currently in April, they're running at -29%, not down 29%, but -29%, which is a 282% decline from the usual run rate. And finally, over 250 hospitals have furloughed or terminated employees due to this current financial crisis. In a bright spot, health system-owned specialty pharmacy has and continues to demonstrate significant resiliency and dependable and growing income for our health system partners. As compared to January and February run rates, we've continued to see revenues increase. This is despite a precipitous decline in specialty clinic visits and new patient diagnoses. So despite the fact that there are less patients coming into the organization, revenues have continued to increase. We will cover telehealth in a second, but as we look forward, we certainly can't, we can predict continued strength in revenue, but the pattern of growth may be very different than what we had previously anticipated. It still remains a little bit unclear how specialty is going to continue to grow, although we know it will, just what pattern and where these patients are going to be coming from and how we're going to see them. So what do we do, or what do we look out for? Well, some of the questions we need to think through. When are clinic volumes going to return? So May appeared to be significantly improved over April. So when we look at our health system partners, their May numbers look much better in terms of total specialty visits. That said, they're still way down. And it's unclear how we're going to budget visit volume for the next 12 months with our health system partners. We know that these volumes are down 50% in many of our partners and in some of the health systems that we talk to every day. There certainly is a deferral of care impact. So just how sick will our patients become? As we discussed in our last webinar, there's clearly a deferral of needed care. It's thought to be that 1 in 3 patients are likely going to defer treatment for an emerging problem. So this is going to be a huge issue for just the population in general, and also for us as health system partners and health system pharmacists. We're going to see sicker, more complex patients, which will play into the management of these patients as well. So, you know, they may not be able to go on the step therapy that's recommended because they'll have to skip a few of those steps, and or their window for a cure may have been missed because of their lack of being seen for a long time. Finally, as I already mentioned, there's a payer impact. So with over 36 million unemployed and COBRA coverage starting to wane, self-pay and Medicaid is anticipated to take a huge swing, so going up. And then health systems are going to have to try to figure out how to continue that. It's always been an unequal balance of payers and managing how reimbursement happens, but really looking at that and trying to shift that to the positive. So switching a bit into telehealth. So is this our new normal? So as many of you know, telehealth wasn't really used before the pandemic. And so it was used in some of our partners, but not extensively, and usually for new services, not existing services. That said, this has rapidly expanded during the crisis. Previously, one of the reasons telemedicine wasn't used is there were a lot of restrictions and not a lot of payment. The good news is this has changed a bit. And so the federal government has focused on loosening restrictions on telehealth, and Medicare beneficiaries are probably the ones that it's easiest right now to provide for them via telehealth, because Medicare will allow you to provide in any state to receive care. HHS has waived the enforcement of HIPAA for telemedicine to an extent. So it's walking a looser line in terms of how to make sure that communication is as secure as it previously was. The DEA has loosened requirements on e-prescribing of controlled substances. On state level, Medicaid's programs have expanded telehealth and relaxed some of the provider licensing rules. And then many states are also mandating that fully insured private plans cover and reimburse telemedicine services at an equal level that they would have to an in-person service. That being said, many of our commercial insurers haven't necessarily fully followed suit. The payment still remains a bit unequal, although there certainly is improvement there. And then health systems have rapidly kind of evolved to make sure that they can meet this. And as you all know, changing and adding telehealth is a Herculean effort for health systems. This is a very different process, a very expensive process, and required moving very, very quickly. And many of the health systems that we work with have done a very good job of doing this, but there were no processes and procedures 3 months ago, and so we're creating them on the fly. Additionally, patients do require a device to receive these telehealth visits, so there remains some socioeconomic disparity in terms of the true impact of telemedicine on our patients. And finally, some providers have noted that patients have kind of lost all personal decorum for showing up to these visits. So patients are showing up to telehealth visits, you know, partially clothed and intoxicated, not really ready for these types of visits. And then finally, in our specialty programs, we know that many of our disease states require either radiology or palpation or injection, other things that are very, very difficult to do from afar. And so while a lot of primary care visits and some of our specialty visits can be done remotely, many of them will require patients coming back into the health system. Finally, the last topic I'm gonna cover before I hand it over to Chris is HRSA. And so this is just a quick update. We talked about this before, but HRSA has announced that it's changing their rules upon request to allow sites that qualify to immediately enroll in the 340B program. They've made some other changes as well, but the one thing that we just wanted to update this group on is we definitely see action happening here. So every Friday, a new list is released of sites that have applied or requested this allowance, and HRSA definitely has been responsive to that. And so certainly we're always here from a Shields perspective if you have any questions on what we're seeing out there, but both from a child site and a contract pharmacy site perspective, we are seeing allowance of early entry into the program. So Chris, I'll hand it over to you now.
Great. So what I wanted to talk about a little bit today was thinking about specialty pharmacy post-COVID and this new reality that you keep hearing in the news. And realizing that, as Aaron said, you know, a lot of states have opened up, are in the process of opening up, and we're going to be faced with a new normal. And what does that look like? So expanding on what Aaron already talked about with telehealth visits and seeing more and more telehealth visits, thinking about that as it relates to specialty pharmacy. So a lot of specialty pharmacies will enroll patients when they come into clinic and you have a physical one-on-one contact point with that patient. But as that goes away, how are you going to operationalize enrolling those patients when they come in for a telehealth visit? Do you have visibility into the appointment schedule for telehealth visits? How are you going to do counseling? Do your pharmacists or pharmacy technicians have access to that same telehealth software where they can do counseling? They can do some of the touch points with the same software. There might be some limitations with technology that might have to be put into place depending on the site. We always have to think about language barriers. So how do you get a translator involved with a patient who needs those services with telehealth? A lot of us are very familiar in the clinic or the hospital settings with the colored phones or iPads. What do you do and what are the logistics around that? And also, as Aaron and Steve will talk about, the 340B implications around telehealth visits and counting that as an encounter. The other thing we're seeing is a lot more shipping. People are starting to leave their homes a little bit more, but a lot of people have just realized that the convenience of shipping, whether it be their medications or groceries, is a lot more convenient. And not having to go beyond their front steps is kind of nice. So you're going to definitely see more and more with that, more patients who elect to have their medication shipped, even if they can come pick it up or pick it up at clinic, they just want it shipped so they don't have to think about it. So thinking about, you know, the projections in increased workload around packaging, cost considerations, if you're shipping a little bit now and able to buy a little bit of shipping materials here and there, you might be looking at buying more in bulk in the future. And also realizing that for those of you who are currently URAC 3.0, that 4.0 is coming and has new requirements around shipping, both for cold chain as well as room temperature. And making sure that you're looking forward to that and what you're going to have to do to change your practices. The other thing I want to talk about is the remote pharmacist work. You know, as a pharmacist, working from home when I was in pharmacy school wasn't a thing. It wasn't a thing 18 months ago or a year ago, but suddenly we see a lot more pharmacists working from home for the time being, and a lot of pharmacists and honestly other industries thinking, do we really need to have an office? Do we really need to have people come in? So the projections of the COVID-19 may have some long-lasting effects on being able to allow pharmacists to work from home, doing some of those counselings, those touching of medications kind of work. So with that, you have to think about infrastructure. What kind of equipment can you use? The security around that equipment, making sure that your pharmacists have access to broadband. How are they going to do phone calls using a service that reroutes their phone lines to have a number that comes up from the hospital? Conferencing software, the telehealth software, it's things to think about that you're probably doing a little bit right now, but things that definitely you're going to see more of in the coming months to years. Also in workflow, not being shoulder to shoulder with providers, how are you going to communicate with providers? Is it through in-basket messaging? Is it through phone calls? Is it through secure text? How are you going to do it with patients? The same things. I think it's a great use as a recruitment tool. I think that if anybody was offered a clinical pharmacist job where they get to work from home, I think you could get some really great talent into those positions, and maybe even from across state lines, depending on your Board of Pharmacy and their regulations around whether it's a non-resident state or something that you can get a non-resident permit for. And with that, I'll shift over to Stephen and financial impact.
Yeah, perfect. Thanks, Chris. The American Hospital Association released a report that forecasted the financial impact of COVID-19 on hospitals and health systems in the United States. During that four-month period between March 1st of 2020 to June 30th of 2020, the report estimated that a total of $202.6 billion in losses, which is an average of $50 billion in losses per month. The report also stated that most health systems were already facing financial pressures prior to the COVID-19 pandemic. Some of the previous financial pressures were due to low payment rates from government payers. As a result of the pandemic, health systems took measures to increase the personal and public safety across the country, while also attempting to preserve PPE. Health systems canceled most elective surgeries, non-essential medical, surgical, and dental procedures. These measures have resulted in adjusted discharges, which is a measure that accounts for both inpatient and outpatient services, decreasing by 13% from the previous year. And as Aaron mentioned earlier, over 200 plus health systems have furloughed staff to help offset the severe financial damage due to declines in patient volumes. Several health systems have had to make the difficult decision to permanently reduce their workforces as well. Due to the economic downturn, there's been an increase in the number of uninsured individuals. There's been an increase in Medicaid enrollment and also an increase in individual coverages through the state and federal marketplaces. COVID-19 has certainly had an impact on patient and procedure volumes within hospitals. One report stated across all service lines in every region of the country, the number of unique patients who sought care in a hospital setting decreased on average by 54.5%. What's more concerning is that clinical care for patients with life-threatening conditions and patients with chronic conditions have also decreased. Healthcare providers continue to raise concerns that patients are foregoing important disease state management, which can further jeopardize their health. I think this is a good time to transition to Gary Kerr as he discusses how his team at Bay State Health are continuing to manage patients' specialty pharmacy needs from the hospital to the home. I will now turn it over to Gary.
Good morning, good afternoon. Thank you, Stephen and Aaron. I'm gonna move quickly and jump right into this. So most importantly, before I set this up, I wanted to talk a little bit about where we are here located geographically and kind of our scope and our history to date. So we're located 90 miles west of Boston and 90 miles east of Albany. We're a four hospital IDN, and the anchor really is the Academic Medical Center, Bay State Medical Center, which is around 800 beds at this point. We are in our seventh year as a specialty pharmacy. We filled our first script in March of 14. March was our busiest month on record. So from a volume perspective, you know, we have had these wacky trends day to day and week to week, but the month of March, we filled 9,000 prescriptions, and that would be our biggest month since we opened. Another comment to make as I go forward, the specialty pharmacy we operate has morphed into a hybrid pharmacy. So we're mixing in retail volume as well as specialty, but the density of the service and the depth of the program really pivots on specialty pharmacy. And we have, right now, I think we have 13 embedded specialty liaisons, and I'll talk about that more as I go forward. So in early to mid-March, we saw our first activity requiring us to respond. We peaked, so the number of Bay State Health bedded COVID positive patients peaked in April 9th, we peaked at 179. We now have dropped off to the mid 60s. So we've seen a dramatic, you know, up slope and then max, and we're starting to tail off. I'm sure It's nowhere near the magnitude of what Frank has seen at Montefiore, but nonetheless, it's caused a dramatic amount of work and reaction and science and workflow modification, et cetera. We, out of the gate, I think kudos to the team, we immediately focused on our employees as well as our patients and caregivers. The safety of individuals without, hurting their care model. We've dealt with dramatic drug shortages. I'll talk about that further. And then we'll talk about some pharmacy operations improvements from a, quality and process improvement perspective. So on this slide, it's fairly, at this point, it's standard and it's kind of rhetorical, but we were obligated to protect our employees and our patients quickly. The plexiglass sneeze guards were installed in really record time. My son works for a national chain, but locally, and we had our, our signage and our preventive devices installed several weeks before their store, so we're proud of that. Your typical floor demarcations and stop signs. We did reconfigure waiting room seating. In many cases, you just don't want people sitting in a waiting room, period. We do have the good fortune of a large open lobby. So if we needed to keep one or two chairs in our already small waiting room, we would do that. But, patients were encouraged to not congregate, obviously, in the small pharmacy space. Very publicly, we strengthened our cleaning and disinfecting processes. All entryways to the clinics, the pharmacy, pharmacy located in clinics, 100% of the entryways were basically blocked and forcing you to, channel through a small opening and have an interaction with a nurse. And surgical masks were handed out. We did go at the hospital, we did go to a no visitor policy, at one point, and with our retail pharmacy located there, that posed, dozens of challenges about people coming in to get refills. As was mentioned earlier, we are in sync with the, we've deployed clinical pharmacists over time to be involved in direct patient care. All of that was really modified to be telephonic, basically following in lockstep with the physicians. So the clinical pharmacy team had their scheduled appointments and just converted them to, telephonic interactions. We've redesigned the logistics around prescriptions. As you know, the specialty model is really predicated on a courier, but some people do walk in. Also, we've pushed out a curbside delivery model as well as lobby base. So at the main hospital, we would deliver prescriptions to the lobby, on demand. And of course, home delivery in and of itself, that's our anchor really for specialty, but we were, obligated to grow that simultaneously, on the concurrent retail side. Very relevant to this audience, we moved quickly to send our embedded liaisons to a remote model. We did keep for, clinical and disease reasons, we did keep our two oncology liaisons on site, as we did keep our reproductive medicine liaison on site. From a drug supply perspective, it's kind of funny how in the early going, there was just this dramatic push for the antimalarials, the chloroquine and the hydroxychloroquine. The poor patients that were chronically ill with RA and lupus were coming in and they wanted extended supplies, not knowing when they would, want to leave their home again. So ironically, we're running out of the drugs for the wrong reasons. That has settled down substantially, outside of our president now, putting himself on hydroxychloroquine and the subsequent demand. But, the push for 90-day supplies, the insurers have relaxed their rules. Early refill overrides are now commonplace. And as I mentioned a minute ago, we have this challenge. We own our own courier. So we have this challenge of now you know, your specialty patients competing with this dramatically growing, you know, the retail population. And, you know, we've prided ourselves on same day capabilities. And in some cases, we've had some conflicts with sustaining that. Albuterol, as you all know, the MDIs early on out of the gate, tremendous demand and supply challenges for us. At one point, we were, you know, looking into Primatene Mist, which is basically a epinephrine product, which was reformulated in December of last year. You know, what are you going to do? There is no other beta agonist to dispense. Again, oral azithromycin, subcutaneous tocilizumab, those have been sporadically unavailable. The key point to make about the enterprise is with our inpatient group, as well as our outpatient platform, a tremendous amount of 24/7 phone calling and, you know, people checking their stock and sharing what we need to keep us all whole and keep our patients, you know, from running out. On the operations innovation side, I already mentioned curbside and Tlabi. You know, the insurers have allowed waiving patient signatures and other, you know, contactless interaction. We've expanded all internal messaging. Basically, it's around diminishing patient foot traffic. The outpatient appointments proper are basically not happening except for emergencies. So we're doing everything in our power to keep, especially the high-risk patients, you know, home and out of the buildings. I mentioned the couriers. We're dealing with this issue today, you know, dealt with it last week, and it will continue to be a challenge for us going forward as this whole thing changes. Our pharmacy residents, I mentioned, have shifted to health reminder telephone campaigns. Our Bay State specialty pharmacy adherence calls have been upgraded to what we would call a well-being or an outreach call. This has been a tremendous, for lack of a better word, call it a marketing tool for us, and the RX capture results are also quite dramatic. You know, on the last slide, just to restate some of what was mentioned earlier, to bring it to life, yes, in April and May, you know, we're very dialed into this telehealth movement. We've got our own challenges around preserving our 340B value due to the encounter files, the way they're recorded and transmitted. We face day to day, we desperately want to get our liaisons back on site to support prior auth, financial assistance, and general care. But we are challenged with the logistics around, you know, where they sit, when they arrive back on site, et cetera. We did get a temporary pharmacy license for an adjoining state of Rhode Island. We did have some patients there. That was a, you know, strategy that we employed. One of our pharmacies has basically adopted a COVID kit strategy. When patients were in the building, we were giving them, you know, a miniature, you know, OTC kit, if you will, so that they wouldn't have to make a stop on the way home. We did have one particular case, which is now being examined more systemically, of people who ran out of food, and the pharmacy department was involved in helping them stay whole with food. On the post-pandemic side, this is, you know, this is scary stuff. I think Stephen mentioned it. We're all working diligently on today, but we're also mindful of what the summer's going to bring. You know, do we need more couriers? Do they need more vehicles? What are we going to do with script volumes and staffing? Are people going to stop taking meds because they can't afford them? You know, we're diligently tracking expenses because of the federal monies that are available. And, you know, unfortunately, we don't know what the new norm will be. We talk about it. But what we're seeing today, don't really know what this will look like in 3 months, 6 months, or a year. So I think that wraps up my portion. Thank you all for your attention.
Thank you so much, Gary, for that presentation. And obviously, I think, unfortunately, we're sharing and seeing the same message across both our partners and other health systems across the country. As a reminder, we are 100% available for any questions that you may have, and I'm sure Gary is welcoming questions as well. We'll make sure that his contact information is made available to you. And as I mentioned earlier, the slides and the recording will be made available. Additionally, I mentioned our policy briefing that we send out on a weekly basis. We also send out a COVID update on a weekly basis to our partners. We certainly would welcome the opportunity to share it with others. It's a very tactical document that helps with things from payer overrides to just current updates in pharmacotherapy. So if you have an interest in receiving that, please do reach out. Again, thank you so much for your time. Thank you, Gary. And then any questions, just please feel free to reach out to any of us. Thank you again and have a great Friday.